The stigma is an inevitable part of the fact that there is a class of people here, and I understand there are some lawyers in the audience, and I'm glad they are here. There is a stigma associated with anything that the government can do by force to the citizen. Because it is in that act that the concept of badness is defined. Badness is not defined in dictionaries, not in a social science encyclopedia or any other dictionary. If the government can do something to you, then by common sense, that is bad. When the government changes that, then it's no longer bad. 3 years ago, if you performed an abortion in New York State, you went to jail. You were a bad man. Now, if you don't perform, now you can perform it and Blue Cross pays for it. And you're a great doctor and make $300,000. So this is an operational definition of the societal meaning of bad, not the moral one. That's why it's important to distinguish between moral, religious concept of bad, and legal ones. The legal ones are meaningless from a moral point of view. They're just conventions. Well, then, the cry for help, which presumably I don't answer. Well, I can't help but assure you that if anyone cries for help, professionally speaking, and is willing to underwrite his crying with a little money, I'll be perfectly happy to help him. Now, of course, if he doesn't, I don't. And in being so honest, I am no doubt much worse than other people who only do this free. The country is full of people who work for free, especially professionals. Now, as far as helping, just helping, there are, of course, endless quotations on this, but... Actually, one of my daughters found this, and it's a classic. And I'll read this one to you, because what else can I say about the helpfulness business? I mean, everything has been said on that score for thousands of years. I have nothing to add to this, so I'll quote. If I knew for certainty that a man was coming to my house with a conscious design of doing me good, I should run for my life. That's from David Thoreau, in case you know. Well, perhaps under the same category, I could touch on the term benign intervention. Now, to call what he does benign intervention is simply not fair play. You know, I don't mind playing games, but we should play by the same rules. I think it would be rather inappropriate for me to define doing something to somebody who doesn't want it as benign. And I don't think I don't quite know what I can do except point this out when he defines involuntary psychiatric interventions as benign. I mean, what, you know, this becomes a kind of a definitional process. I mean, who has the power to make this definition? He, the patient, I don't want to arrogate the power to myself. My general position on psychiatry and the English language is that in psychiatry, as in medicine, the patient should define what is illness, what is cure, what is treatment, and so forth. Not the doctor. The doctor should be able to define it for himself. The patient should be able to define it as far as the intervention goes. If somebody wants to define lobar pneumonia as not illness and stay home and not, you know, and go to a Christian Science healer, obviously he should have that right. Now, that's a definition I don't share, but I should not be able to impose it on him. Now, similarly, the issue of benign intervention, I think, is very distracting. Now, the whole business of addiction, I note here, I don't want to digress on. I was rather amused by the being called oxymoronic, but but it occurred to me that it's really, I'd rather be oxymoronic than psychodynamic.
<You're> very funny.
Well, maybe I should quit while I'm ahead. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
you. Thank you very much. Jerry, I wonder if I could ask you to come forward and help us with some sorting on the questions.
Can I say one thing?
One thing.
maybe I meant psychomoronic.
That's an improvement.
Okay, what we're going to do is we have here a number of questions from you all, and my phone upbringing. If the proctors will bring forward any others that you add, I have a couple here, and if you'll sort through and kind of help pass them on to who they go to, we'll try and get the questions that you'd like to raise answered. Jerry, you selected one for me, which is quite a lengthy question, but if you'll bear with me, we'll read through this. This is to Dr. Saz. This is a true case which exposes the ambivalence of suicide in sharp focus. My patient with multiple personality had a very ambivalent wish to die. Mary number one wished to live. Mary number two announced to me at an appointment that she had a gun waiting for her when she left the office. She had, in fact, jumped off a cliff 2 days earlier but survived. I kept Mary number one and number two, being housed in the same body, on an involuntary hold for 72 hours. Before the 72 hours expired, Mary number one reemerged and expressed great relief that Mary number two had not killed the two of her. Her gratitude is not the issue, however. Please tell me how your philosophy can help solve a dilemma like this. Which Mary has the right to suicide, and with whom shall a therapist align? Shall we agree with whichever personality happens to emerge in a given session? Do we have a responsibility and charge from Mary number one to help protect her from Mary number two? If we allow Mary number two freedom to suicide, since Mary number two and number one are really only one highly ambivalent person, who shall really be free? And if we allow Mary number two to emigrate, are we not preventing number one from returning home?
This would be easier, though. This would be easier. That's a very nicely phrased, poetic question. So let me first try to answer in kind. As soon as Mary number three comes forward, I'll be glad to answer the question. Please let that sink in. Now I'll give you a more serious answer. You see, the question, language is tremendously important, and I can tell you that the answer to most of these problems lies in what you could call linguistic analysis or philosophical analysis, if you want to speak in an oxymoronic way, or you could or you could simply call it plain English. This whole question is very difficult to answer in this form because it's already been couched in such a way that there are two Marys. And therefore, you know, the questioner has got me against the ropes if I have to answer within this framework. In a political framework, in a civil rights framework, there's only one person, a person with gravely mixed feelings about a great many issues. Now, within that context, I will, if I can translate back into plain English, I'll be glad to answer it. Where is the problem? Let's assume that this were my patient. I can only tell you what I would do. And whatever this doctor who asks my general view would be, he can do what he wants. I'm not quite sure what he's asking. I have an understanding with a patient. This often happens before the patient even comes, but certainly as soon as anything like this comes up, an understanding, you can call it a contract, that the only thing I do, the absolutely only thing, is listen, talk, and collect money. So there's no problem. I no more intervene in suicide than in anything else. This is a pseudo problem. Now if the doctor has an understanding with the patient that when an ambivalent situation of suicide is prevented, he is to act on the side of preventing suicide rather than saying it's your business, then that's his duty. This is a question of what kind of contract. What is he selling to this patient? if the patient is buying this kind of an infantile kind of an arrangement, that, you know, when I am in doubt and I feel like killing myself, you'll stop me. This essentially is an alcoholic game, which, you know, is well known, which Eric Byrne described in rather cute terms, you know. If somebody wants to play, if some wife wants to play with her husband the game of hiding bottles around the house, well, they are welcome to that. That's their business. If some doctor wants to play this kind of suicide game, I will prevent you from killing yourself, more luck to them. I don't want to prevent it. This may be a fairly unsatisfactory answer, but it's the best I can do. This is my view on it. I simply, in my own view, I do not think it is politically, morally legitimate, legally, to have involuntary psychiatric interventions. So if society, if social rules were modified and involuntary interventions were abolished, then to some extent this doctor's question would be quite different. Because if then he would prevent Mary number, whichever it is, the one who wants to kill herself, and would hospitalize her, then Mary number one would be in a wonderful position to collect $1 million by turning around and suing him for an illegal act. And I very much hope that we will get to that. See, if somebody is ambivalent, if somebody goes to a doctor with a terrible gallbladder, a middle-aged lady, and, you know, has a long negotiation with the surgeon and says, I really don't know what to do. Should I have it out? Shouldn't I have it out? And the doctor can't stand it, gets nervous, and, you know, restrains the patient, takes her to the hospital and has the gallbladder out, you know what will happen to the doctor. So this is really, you have to simply think more about this question in terms of the moral and legal issues, not in terms of how many Marys there are, because that's already psychiatrizing it. There is only one Mary.
These are sort of summary things that typify a lot of the stuff.
Dr. Schneidman, could you please give us a concise statement of your position in the issue of suicide and justify your beliefs? Your rebuttal came prior to your statement, and I am unclear as to your actual position. This note was written prior to Dr. Saz's rebuttal. I assume, therefore, that you will try and answer both our questions as to your position. This is the second question attached in here. What happens to a person who goes for help to a suicide prevention center? What are the do they work with hospitals or psychiatric wards?
Well,
now that we asked.
Well, let me see. First, I have to recover from what has happened in the last 5 to 10 minutes. A concise statement of my position on the issue of suicide and justify my beliefs. Now, I believe that life sometimes presents us with a choice between lousy alternatives. It's the nature of life. I wish it were not so. And sometimes we have to take the risk of, as it were, bifurcating, separating, taking somewhat extreme positions on certain issues in which we believe. I'm willing to say that in this I'm more of an extremist than Dr. Saz. I see from the remarks he's just made that he's much more moderate and in the middle on these issues than I am. Apparently I'm willing to speak for those who are willing to do more at the risk, admittedly, the risk of interfering more. I think that that's a concise statement of my position. I'd hate to be drowning in his presence. I say that seriously. And I wouldn't go to him as a patient, and obviously some of you would, and there are differences in attitudes. Quoting Camus, one can then quote Kierkegaard and Heidegger on the same issue. But really, I was distressed when the Nobel Prize winner Kawabata committed suicide 2 weeks ago. It was a kind of innocent, stupid, native gut reaction. And had Kawabata come to me, this is all nonsensical imagining, there's a first of all, the, you know, problem of Japanese and so on. But had he come to me, I don't think I would have tried to dissuade him. I know that I would have tried to dissuade him. For many reasons, because he saddened me by his death. I've read A Snow Country and A Thousand Cranes with some interest, and that life cut off prematurely is a tragedy. Now, I'll leave it at that. I don't think it'd be appropriate to rebut each point. That is, I'm not persuaded at all by Dr. Saz's talking about the rules of the game. He changes them as he goes along. That is, there's no reason why we should play by the same rules any more than we should go to the same authorities. He has a nasty trick, though, of uttering partial truths. The people to whom I referred were medical authorities. And granted that I went to two encyclopedias, those others are medical authorities. It's interesting, and I put it to your mind, that he is fulminating against American psychiatry. I happen to be an American psychologist who is taking the position that lives in balance ought to be saved. So that target, you see, is not entirely an appropriate one. I think that his answer, I happen to know the question about that dissociative girl from whom it comes and what it represents. That's a cop-out, that answer, and I find myself somewhat troubled and puzzled that he would see someone who cries for help if they're willing to underwrite that contract with money. And I put it in my own mind this way, that anyone who comes to help for help, implicitly, there's a contract in the air. I put this in my own paper, that one ought not ordinarily abrogate the position in which he is put as helper. I don't see that as undemocratic. I see a great difference between parent and child. And I think that that the notions of democracy, which I prize highly, can be distorted easily. If you think that you're a co-equal with your child, you'll scare him and abrogate some of the opportunities for responsibility which you have as a parent. Now, this philosophy obviously pervades my work in suicide prevention. I don't know how it pervades others. To say that suicide prevention centers is a manufacturing of illness by American psychiatry is shrill. Really, it is, Tom. The LASPC was started by two psychologists, Norm Farbrow and me, and this was not in an effort, unless it was deeply unconscious in us. And I'm sorry, incidentally, that I didn't simply mention in passing Einstein and Darwin, so that you could simply say that those weren't giant ideas either. But this was started out of our impulses that there ought to be some kind of response within the context that we both understand that electrocoma treatments are being given. That doesn't mean we endorse their use, the way people are dragged to them, and so on. That lobotomy for a while was a fad. That doesn't mean we endorsed it. I viewed it as a heinous thing.
Did you say so anywhere?
Did I say so anywhere?
Yes.
Yes.
Where?
Yes.
Where?
Specifically where?
Yes.
Now let me see.
What would you say if I would have told you that I went through your book called Clues to Suicide, in which in the index the word involuntary mental hospitalization, commitment, or force are not listed. No such entry as involuntary mental hospitalization.
I would say you're not proving a thing, and I would point out to you that you're referring to an edited book.
By you?
Yes.
Yes. Now,
you made the index, or were responsible for it?
No, McGraw-Hill made the index.
Under your auspices, you paid for the index. You are the agent of the index.
BFD.
Okay.
All right, let's get back to a loftier level.
Big fucking deal.
Let's go to the next question.
Yeah.
I have another question.
No, may I make a comment about it? I think that Dr. Schneidman is pretending to a kind of, and I'm being really quite nasty now, but I hope in a fairly pleasant way, pretending to a kind of compassion, which is simply a way of making me look cold and brutal or something, which I repudiate. I brought along, I was quite struck by this Japanese man's suicide, and since it happened just recently, I got the clipping. I'd like to read to you something about it, because he was so distressed by this. His words were premature death. That's what you said, Dr. Schneidman.
You're right.
Nobel Prize-winning novelist Yasunari Kawabata committed suicide Sunday in his workroom at an apartment house in Zushi, a seaside resort near here, police reported. Period. Next line. He was 72 and had been in ill health.
I was aware of that.
So one should be hooked up to lousy machines for the next 2 years and live like a cadaver? That's your idea of death? There is no time to die?
Where does that say that?
I'm asking you.
No.
Is there a time to die?
Tell me.
It's not a waste.
Tell me where it says he's going to be hooked up to a machine and
that
live like
I did
a
not say that. I'm quoting. I was clear when I was quoting.
No, tell me where you get that.
I told you that I am getting that from the way elderly, sick people are treated in hospitals all over the country.
Well,
how many old people are hooked up in this hospital? Are you denying that? I mean, you're not in the same word. Are you denying that gerontology is this kind of a lousy medical game?
Tom, you're full of BS on the score in Kawabata. The fact is that so far as anyone can tell in this country, what he was in anguish about was the suicide of Mishima Yukio, and that this is a very complicated event, and you suddenly go into gerontology and give us a dramatic image.
Well, he was 72 years old. That's not exactly a spring chicken.
that's a smart aleck remark, but that's not the point.
No, that's long enough to live.
Oh, really?
Well, some people think so.
Well, you frighten me.
Gentlemen, and I use the term loosely. Dr. Saz, how do you assess volition? If a person comes to a suicide prevention center and says, I want to kill myself, do you infer volition from his verbal behavior, in which case you might infer that he wants to kill himself, or do you infer volition from the fact that he came to a suicide prevention center, in which case you infer he wants to live? Or is volition, perhaps, as Dr. Schneidman suggests, not a unitary concept? If people want to both live and die at the same time, how does this affect your position? Which is somewhat redundant.
Well, I don't understand the question. It doesn't seem to me that anything I have said hinges upon a denial of the concept of ambivalence, that people want different things at the same time. When most people go to Las Vegas and play roulette, I imagine that they would like to put their money both on red and black and win either way. That's human nature. This is not a problem. A person who comes to a suicide prevention center or to a private psychiatrist for that matter and talks about suicide is a person who is troubled, who wants to talk about suicide, but has yet have not put it into action. Again, it's a matter of plain English. I don't understand what the question is. How does it affect what position?
This reinforces my notion that Dr. Saz does not understand ambivalence. The person who goes to Las Vegas wants to win. And red and black are the procedures and the details of getting to the goal. And that's if that's his example, that's a very poor example.
So I'll use fewer examples from now.
Okay, let's give you a chance to hear. This is Dr. Saz. I have a great deal of admiration and respect for your views, but I
want you to read a question to me that begins that way.
You didn't let me get to the next word. Yeah. The next word is but.
Forget it.
I have a question which I'd like to hear your view. As a suicide prevention center volunteer, parenthetically, not a psychiatrist, would you have any feelings about my sending help to someone who had called, for example, after having taken an overdose of drugs?
Again, I would want to make this highly operational. If this person has given you their name and address, and has told you that they have taken a drug, I would have absolutely no objection, because that would, to me, would mean that this is what they were asking for. I think the tricky issue comes up, what happens after the ambulance or the police get there? And what may let's assume that what happens is, which so often happens, is that what is called a suicidal attempt is in fact not a suicidal attempt, but you know, what psychiatrists call is a gesture. Let's assume this person took 8 aspirin tablets, and he now says, leave me alone. And let's assume that her husband says, no, it was 30 seconds. What does the police do then? Or the doctor? I put it back to you. I have absolutely no objection, I'm glad to reiterate this, to giving help. In fact, I firmly believe that psychiatric help, including help about suicide, can be given more effectively if there is no threat of coercion overhanging it. I think I can be more effective in my work with persons who are suicidal, because they know that they can talk as freely about suicide as they can about, excuse me, the examples, the stock market, or marriage, or divorce, and I will not intervene in the one anymore in the other. But I do not get uptight about it. I'm quite willing to talk to them and share with them their ideas about life and death and disease, and whatever, and give them mine. And the ultimate decision remains in their hands. So that, as I said, I'm repeating it, I have no objection to this kind of intervention.
Tom, a patient, this is a true thing. A patient was in my office at the LASPC some years ago, and toward the end of the session, she opened her purse and she showed me a small automatic. Right? And she said, I am going to go out and kill that son of a bitch, meaning her husband.
He had it coming, probably.
You mustn't smart aleck us into this. You mustn't.
Why not? It's a perfectly legitimate argument.
Oh, well, that answers the question.
No, it doesn't, because I don't know what the question is. What's the question?
Well, I said.
What's the question?
Would you agree? What would you have done? But let me tell you what I did.
Patients don't do this to me. They don't play such games with me. You see, he was testing you. You know psychoanalysis. Now I'll talk psychodynamics. He was testing you to see what you'll do.
See, first thing you have to do is get the sex right.
Okay. See.
Go ahead.
I have nothing else to say. What's the problem? What is your question? What are you asking?
My question is, would you let her leave the office with the gun in her purse?
Well, my position on this is crystal clear. It's not a question of would I let her. I do not construe my role as one of restraining people from killing each other. More power to them. And then but I am in favor, and I am on record for this, of then punishing them severely and not introducing psychiatric testimony to get them off.
Except the same.
That's clear.
Husbands and wives killing each other is a time-honored method of divorce. Incidentally, in some cultures, it's much more acceptable than divorce. Like Italy, where divorce is illegal and immoral and irreligious, but if you can concoct the proper justification, like that your wife sleeps with somebody, then it's okay to kill her. Now, that's a nice morality. That's why I keep telling you this is a moral issue. I don't like that kind of morality. I don't like people killing each other. That's why I say, Let's be careful about how we prevent it. Let's get those who do it.
Well, that sounds like the last question could probably be answered in a sentence or two, and we will be on schedule, which is directed to both gentlemen.
Yeah. I must say that we have a great many excellent questions, and I regret very much that our time limitations won't permit all of them to be responded to. But we will pass them on.
I think that all the questions ought to be read.
We will pass them on to the participants, and it's very possible that this afternoon in the open field, sort of free-for-all, it'll be possible to answer them.
I don't think I can take it anymore.
Bulletproof Svesta recommend.
I'm training with you this afternoon, Jerry. This one just simply says, what is your objection to suicide prevention programs with no legal control over the patient, that is, voluntary suicide prevention? I think that can probably, from what I've gathered, be answered very simply. Want to go first, Dr. Sasser, or would you rather reverse it this time?
I'd rather reverse it.
I think we can answer that very simply.
Well, I'm especially good at true-false. I have no objection.
I have no great objection either. Maybe we finally agree on something.
Let's adjourn for lunch.
Not yet.
I don't know about you, but I want to march.
Not yet. From a political and economic point of view, there is a very serious question of priorities. I might as well throw in the money issue, because it looks like, you know, only I work for money and nobody else does. The fact is that there is only so much money to go around, and the economic state of this country is not exactly rosy. And I think it's a legitimate question for an intelligent people in a democracy to debate whether or not they want to spend their money, their tax monies, on suicide prevention. So that it isn't that I have any objection to it, but I would think this is an activity much more appropriately handled through voluntary philanthropies, private agencies, religious bodies, than through tax monies.
Would you tell us?
Especially when the government, as I see it, is basically, and this is a Lockean view, the business of the government is to kill. That is what government is about. To kill foreign enemies and to kill people who disturb the internal peace. And insofar as the government gets into the business of protecting people's own welfare, we are on a very, very complicated road. Now, I'm not against, in some blanket, against the welfare state. But the idea of spending tax money on suicide prevention, I don't like at all. I'm not against it in any vehement sense. I mean, lots of money is wasted in much worse ways, so I'm not going to get excited about this. But I think it's an issue worth raising.
I'd like to clarify a question, Dr. Schneider. I don't see how you can steal away from the question that lightly. If you have no objection to limiting suicide prevention programs to strictly voluntary programs, then it seems to me you have an obligation to be fighting the mental health commitment laws which are a part of them, which allow people to be put in the hospital against their will or in prison.
I'll answer it after lunch.
Dr. Schneider would prefer to answer that during the open question period. So I think that what we'll do is ask you all to take your 1 hour break and be back promptly at 1:30 when we'll pick up again. Thank you.
Oh, boy.
My name is Dave. I'm an intern.
Our four panelists this afternoon are intimately involved with the issues that are being debated and in different ways. We have with us a psychiatrist who serves as director of the country's first and foremost suicide prevention center. And I think he's certainly involved in a very direct and pragmatic way with the issues of suicide prevention. The philosophical nature of these issues, I think, are very obvious, and so we invited a philosopher to join us. Suicide is considered a major public health problem, and its prevention is viewed as a public health responsibility. So we've invited the director of the County Department of Public Health and Welfare to join us. And we have another psychiatrist with us, a behavioral scientist who primarily is a teacher and who teaches tomorrow's psychiatrists. We feel that they're each uniquely qualified to amplify our discussion today. And so I'm going to begin introducing our panelists. Our first panelist is Dr. Robert Littman, chief psychiatrist and co-director of the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Center. He's professor of psychiatry at the University of Southern California School of Medicine and training and supervising analyst at the Southern California Psychoanalytic Institute. His publications include numerous articles on the legal and medical aspects of suicide, and as you heard this morning, on Sigmund Freud also. And I'm going to proceed on the assumption that you'd rather hear from these people and about them and keep the introductions fairly short. So, Bob?
This is Ross. Ladies and gentlemen, you can hear me? Okay? This thing is working. All right. Unlike Dr. Schneidman, I am a psychiatrist. I had my training right here on the hill at the Estes Direction Langley Porter Clinic more than 25 years ago. I was taught how to do shock treatment, how to do lobotomy. I was taught that suicidal people are best treated in hospitals. That possibly is part of the myth of the title about suicide prevention, myth or mandate. Experiences later and studies, of which there are almost none, have led me gradually to change my mind so that in the last 10 years when I've written on this subject, I have tended to express the notion that hospitalization of suicidal people raises just as many problems as it tends to solve. It would be great to have crash pads or living centers, some place where a person who is in a desperate social situation could find some respite or relief for a period. The difficulty comes always, though, when the person leaves his center, when he leaves the place where he's been sheltered. And I'm going to talk about that after a while. Now, another myth, I think, has to do I think Dr. Schneidman, sometimes I feel that you tend to make suicide prevention seem too easy. It's never been easy for me. Over and over again, I have been struck by the experience that what I hoped would be a crisis reaction in a patient or a client turned out not to be a crisis of suicide, but a career of suicide. So that it was more than a crisis intervention and a helping hand, but more a effort to try to help someone with change a way of living with very few tools to work with. So it's not easy. Suicide prevention isn't easy for anyone involved. Now, I think there's a myth that Dr. Saz gave voice to, and which is that there is some unanimity somewhere, that someone speaks, is authorized to speak for psychiatry or for suicide prevention. That's not so. There's just as much ambivalence on key issues among psychiatrists and among suicide prevention workers as there is in the heart of the person who contemplates choices between all the choices, including life and death. I will give some examples of that, those mixed feelings, in a little while. I want to consider the other side of the title, mandate, then. I can't agree with what Dr. Saz says flippantly, that the mandate of government or the principle of government is to kill. That's really not right. We put governments together for our general welfare. We each of us give some of our autonomy up to government in return for consideration that we'll take care of things that we all need to do together. No one of us can do it alone. What is the mandate of government with regard to suicide? I want to put in some factual information on that. Now, suicide is not against the law in most parts of the United States. There is a law against suicide in 7 states. It's not against the law in New York, where Dr. Saz comes from. It was against the law until 1949. That law was then repealed. The repealer is sort of cute. It says, we recognize that suicide is a grave social wrong, but there's no way that one can legislate effectively against it being impossible to punish the person who has committed suicide. So the law was repealed. There has never been a law against suicide in California. There is a law in California that says it is a felony to aid, assist, encourage, or abet someone else's suicide. Your own is perfectly legal. However, the problem focuses, swirls around commitment procedures. Now, the present California commitment law, the so-called Landerman-Petras short law, was written, went into effect about 2 years ago. Before that, there were many hearings. These laws are in the process of change, and to those hearings were invited many different people to give their opinions, including the suicide prevention movement was invited. Here's where the ambivalence came in. There were some people representing suicide prevention who said there should be no law about committing people for self-destructiveness. I think the San Francisco group took that position. There were others who said, yes, there should be a brief commitment for people who are highly suicidal. I know I was asked for my opinion, and I wrote to the committee, and I said, I knew of no evidence, no scientific evidence, that committing people to a hospital had prevented suicide. And I was looking for some, and I would follow whatever happened after the passage of the act to see if there would be any changes. I think it's the feedback I get, and I have obtained at this meeting, is that, now this new law was passed, and there is a specific provision in the law that people can be held for 72 hours if a peace officer takes them to a psychiatric installation and it's felt necessary on grounds that they may destroy themselves or be harmful to themselves. After which there's sort of a complicated procedure, but what it amounts to, the person can be held for another 14 days on these grounds if he shows evidence in the hospital that he is still suicidal. After 14 days, he can no longer be held. Now, in the same law, in California, it is illegal to force anyone to take drugs against their will or to force anyone to accept electric treatment or any other kind of treatment involuntarily. Now, there are breaches of that in practice, and I'm sure that many people don't know their rights in this respect. But that is the current situation in California. Just as an aside, I feel that psychiatric hospitals and psychiatrists who work in hospitals are caught in a very painful dilemma, only partly of their own making. That is, if someone does commit suicide in a psychiatric hospital, or in any hospital, And I can say to you, there is no way to prevent a person from committing suicide by restraint. No restraints can do that. People have committed suicide under conditions of total restraint in total security installations and in hospitals. But if that happens, if it happens in a psychiatric hospital, there's a lawsuit against the hospital charging negligence 3 out of 4 times. And if it happens in a general medical hospital, there's a lawsuit 1 out of 3 times. So that it places the hospitals in the position of a surveillance, which might not be their proper function. There'd be some disagreement about that, or just to what degree that should be their function. Again, I'm trying to present the facts. What's the issue here at this debate? I think the issue has to do, I suppose, with the quality of life we lead. As I think both Dr. Schneidman and Dr. Sass would agree that there are circumstances where, that in general, life has a high value, although there are occasionally circumstances in which other values maybe have even a higher value. But in general, we're concerned not only with life itself, but with the quality of life. And I want to consider then, something about the contribution of suicide prevention activities to the general quality of life. Well, I think in the first place that suicide is a touchstone to life. I can see why Camus was preoccupied at all his thinking life. It's a subject of discourse and concern to people who think about the meaning of life. I think it's nonsense, though, to think that suicide is the exclusive concern of psychiatry, any more than it is the exclusive concern of religion, or of philosophy, or of law. Now, all these disciplines and many others, all those who are responsible in part for our general welfare, are concerned as part of their activities with the problem of suicide prevention. In general, we all would agree, and I think Dr. Soss does too, that suicide, by and large, in general, most of the time, is a grave social wrong. It detracts from the general welfare. It's a signal of something wrong with the quality of our lives. Now, what can we do about it? You see, we're certainly it's not the responsibility of government to make sure that we don't commit suicide, or it is a not the highest priority of government. It's a problem for, to some extent, for mental health people. It's a problem for clergymen, religious people, lawyers, the legal. It's quality. It's a problem for everyone. I really think that suicide is prevented. I sometimes wonder at times why all of us don't commit suicide. It seems to me at times the object for wonderment is why the suicide rate is so low. And I think the reasons we don't commit suicide is something to do with, meaningful activity, meaningful work, and the network of people that we love and relate to. Those two things. Now, do suicide prevention activities increase the quality of meaningfulness in work and in the network of human relationships? I think they should be judged by that, and I suppose on a cost basis, if some government money, very little government money goes into this at present, if some government money is to go into it, it is to be judged on that basis. I have a feeling that Dr. Soss, to make a point, over-projects himself as making a religion of autonomy. That his, I think he knows his vision of autonomous man is mythical, that the people that come to see him are benefited not only by paying his bill and by discoursing of this and that, but by the warmth he projects into his personal relationship with them. And I think that, I think in his discourses in public, he rather deliberately overemphasizes the importance of law and order, of rules and regulations, of contracts and discipline, and of fees and payment. But I think I would like to correct that by saying something about love, friendship, kindness, that sort of thing, warmth. And I think that in a society where people sort of drift apart, where there's a lot of alienation, a lot of mechanization, super mobility, maybe too much thinking, the suicide prevention... The suicide prevention movement as a movement sort of symbolizes the social forces in the other direction toward joining hands, working together, forming groups, sharing love, trying to help one another.
Thank you, Speaker. Dr. George Pickett is director of the San Mateo County Department of Public Health and Welfare. Before coming to the Bay Area last year, Dr. Pickett served as public health director of Detroit and Wayne County Health Departments. His research efforts in the past had been directed toward such problems as environment, smoking, and syphilis. I don't know why we got you in San Mateo County. His publications include Noise and Man, Smoking and Health, and the Epidemiology of Chronic Disease. I think it's of note that the health department, which Dr. Pickett directs, was the first in California to award Short Doyle's support to a suicide prevention center. And I simply want to comment that after Dr. Saz's morning remarks, I thank you, Bob, for what you said, and hope someone else will speak to the point since it's my center that's funded there.
I was looking in my briefcase for something I thought I had about you, Charlotte, and I can't find it, unfortunately.
Thank God.
Charlotte, you know, when she originally asked me to appear on this panel some time ago, I had in mind the fact that we do, in fact, put money into the Suicide Prevention Center and that there might be some reason for having me on the panel. She had the poor taste, I thought, to describe it later to me as a panel which was made up of two psychiatrists, a philosopher, and a bureaucrat. I'm going to leave it to the other three panelists to see if they've got any problems dealing with those definitions at this stage of the game. This question of tax money, it seems to me remarkably insignificant because I can find very little difference anymore between the money I supposedly contribute voluntarily to public causes and the money that the government takes out of my wallet. It's all public dollars, and who pays for it, I really think, is not much of an issue. I did one thing in preparing for this meeting. I somewhat persistently resisted reading anything about suicide. I didn't know anything about it before I got here. I won't make any comments about what I know about it now. I thought it would be sheer folly for me to try to become an expert in that short amount of time, and considering what I heard about experts this morning, I think it was the wisest decision. The issue that I see being raised really is not suicide itself. I don't want to put words in anybody else's mouth, but I think what's really being talked about is personal liberty. And suicide in itself is perhaps that most extreme expression of this decision. Which therefore I think makes it a very good one to talk about. But I think the issue that Dr. Saz brings to my mind, certainly, whether he intends to or not, I don't know, but what he brings to my mind is the whole problem of personal liberty and personal autonomy in society. And it seems to me, and I did come with that in mind, in fact, so I guess I did think a little bit about it, that that's an incredibly important question in 1970 in the United States, as well as in other nations. And it's got to have some answers. I think it requires persistent, prolonged, and deep public debate. And I'm very distressed that that didn't really happen this morning. I think that it was an unfortunate series of events in which Dr. Schneidman's comments really didn't, in my mind, at all focus on this overwhelming and critically important issue which Dr. Saz does raise. I felt in... I really felt that I was back in about 1964 and was listening to a weird twist on the argument between the American Cancer Society and the tobacco industry in the United States, in which they responded against the attacks on their position with rhetoric rather than logic, and to no real avail. In fact, I have to say, Dr. Schneidman, that at one point I questioned whether or not, knowing your history and having read some of your material, knowing of your reputation, that those of us who were concerned about it might not feel called upon to rise up and restrain you from committing intellectual suicide in front of the rest of us at times. What puzzled me a lot, I think, was there's one similar theme that ran through both the debaters' lines of thought, really. Dr. Schneidman mentioned that he was afraid that Dr. Soz's comments, if let loose in the public, would work very serious mischief upon the minds of the young. That, to me, is one of the most dangerous comments I've heard all day. And I think while I find it difficult personally to operate from Dr. Soz's viewpoint, I think to bury it by saying that it may wreak mischief upon the minds of the youth of this country is a disservice to it. On the other hand, I think Dr. Soz really oversimplifies the argument, and this is stating what may be on a lot of our minds today. It's not as quite as simple, I think, at least I can't live with it as simply as Dr. Soz can. We do, in fact, intervene in people's lives all the time. There are subtle differences, but those differences themselves, I think, raise questions. I'll avoid mentioning the one disease that Charlotte did, since unfortunately it still provokes a good deal of humor, but I do know it's my responsibility to restrain those who have a communicable disease and who may infect others in our society. That's a critical difference, of course, that they serve as a danger to others in our society. I cannot, in fact, treat somebody with active tuberculosis if they choose not to be treated, nor can I, in fact, treat somebody with smallpox or any of the other dread diseases if they refuse treatment. But I can, and I have, locked them up, restrained them from public access, as I am called upon to do in law, and as I think, in fact, society presently expects me to do. I think there is too subtle a difference to yield to Dr. Soz's resolution of this problem to simply state that on the one hand you're protecting society by isolating or restraining this person, and on the other hand we're talking about restraining the person from harming himself. Because that decision operationally becomes a highly difficult one to make, and a very, very subtle one at times. And we can each conjure up anecdotes in which the answer to that is not really so simple. The question really is when we're protecting others, and who's going to make that decision, and what does society expect us to do, really? I was intrigued, I think, in a way, in describing this issue and man's control over himself and his own fate, that Dr. Soz paid some tribute to what might be called military logic, and that puzzled me, you know, considering the rest of his background and interest, because I'm not sure that he would tout the military mentality as the way to autonomy and personal liberty in the United States. But he did make some persistently, twice that I detected at any rate, and perhaps other times, a point that I was concerned about on the way in here this morning. I kept wondering, what would Dr. Soz say about restraining the adolescent from committing suicide? And I really felt for sure that he must have an answer to it, and I hope, frankly, that I was going to hear about it this morning. But what I heard twice was that he made his remarks pointedly in talking about adults. And that inferred to me, at least, that he would feel differently about children. And this, again, then raises to me a question of oversimplifying a process which doesn't lend itself to that. I'm not sure what the answer is with a disturbed adolescent child, and I'm not sure. I hope Dr. Soz will comment upon that, because he inferred, at least to me, that he felt differently about a child than an adult. And that, too, raises some immediate questions in my mind about living with his way of settling a very grave society issue, that is, restraint of personal liberty.